All right. Is the administration trading short-term gains, jobs in the coal industry, for long-term benefits from scientific research? Carly?
Well, I do think short-termism is a big problem. It's a big problem in politics. It's a big problem in business, where people get fixated on a short-term win rather than a long-term solution. In this particular case, I actually think we could have it both ways. I mean, let's face it, it's a problem when a candidate like Hillary Clinton says, we're going to put all those coal miners out of work. That's a problem for the coal miners and their communities. I've been to those coal mining communities. And what I see are people who had a lot of pride in their work and who don't understand why their government is making it harder for them to work. I absolutely accept the scientific evidence. But I also read the fine print of the scientific evidence on climate change and global warming. And what the fine print says is that a single nation acting alone will make no difference at all. And so the key to this problem, this insoluble problem, is the same key as to many insoluble problems: innovation. I think we're shooting ourselves in the foot so often. Let's just take the coal industry as one example, or we could pick oil, you know, two dirty energy sources. We have cleaner burning coal than China. And yet we are shutting our coal industry down and China is churning theirs up. We could focus a lot of energy on clean coal and innovate, because the Chinese are still buying coal and selling coal. We would actually help the environment in that way, but we also might keep people employed for a little while longer. Oil is the same way. We prevented American oil companies from exporting for 25 years. And yet, the oil that we export out of this nation, light sweet crude, is cleaner burning, better for the environment than heavy sour crude. Who produces heavy sour crude? Iran, who can now export? Venezuela, Russia, Saudi Arabia. We are not helping the environment. When we shut our own industries down, when we put our own people out of jobs, we're not helping the environment. We're actually making it worse. This is a country that figures out how to innovate and solve problems. And you can't innovate if you don't have strong industries. And our energy is better for the environment than anyone else's in the world. We should lead in clean energy. We should lead in solar. We should lead in wind. We should lead in all these alternative energies. But we should also lead in innovations that impact the energy sources that most of the world still uses and will continue to use for the next 50 years.
Bob, I think I disagree, but I'm not sure, because you did encapsulate a lot of good things in that statement. But here's the reality. The reality is that the Trump administration is now basically shutting down a lot of innovation in the environment with regard to non-carbon-based energy, and these wind-based and solar-based and biomass-based, and there are a lot of great technologies that are gaining ground. China is becoming a leader in solar technologies. No reason we should relinquish our leadership there. In terms of jobs, there are so many potential jobs in green technologies, in terms of everything from installing and upgrading and monitoring the machinery, the technologies. Why aren't we really making a major effort here? Why are we going in the opposite direction? That's what worries me. We're basically saying to the rest of the world, we might even turn our back on the Paris Agreement. I mean, what irresponsibility is that?
Well, where Bob and I just can't let it go. Where Bob and I disagree is, yes, by all means, let's have innovation in green industries. Where he and I disagree is, I don't think government subsidies help innovation. I think they crush innovation. Secondly, if we want innovation in green energy, great. But why don't we want innovation in oil and coal, which most of the rest of the world still uses and much of our country still uses?
But Carly,
Waters of the U.S., which started here in California, Waters of the U.S., the federal government regulating 97% of the groundwater in this nation, Folks, that's insanity, because the government's going to do a really bad job of managing the groundwater in this country. That's one of those problems that the federal government shouldn't control. Let state governments deal with it, trust communities to deal with it. But when you have the federal government regulating a puddle in a farm, and that's what they would regulate under the waters of the U.S., we have gone too far.
Well, let me just respond. Because I'm not making an argument in favor of big government and heavy-handed subsidies. I'm making an argument that says we were heading in a good direction. Regulation can actually promote innovation in technologies, particularly green technologies. Look at California. I mean, California is the leader in green technologies, and we are also the leader in innovation in green technologies, partly because we have set very high standards, higher standards than the rest of the country. If the rest of the country followed us, the rest of the country would not only be doing a service to our economy, but also to the world. So why reject where California is going? Why head as fast as possible in the opposite direction?
Well, but here's what's also happening in California.
Last
I know
point.
Bob Leon wants to get off this. Here's what's also happening in California, the exodus of jobs. The exodus of the middle class, the highest income inequality in the nation, the highest poverty rates in the nation, an agriculture industry that used to be the strongest in the world that now is now on its back. That's also what's happening in California. And it's great that entrepreneurs get wealthy on federal government subsidies, but I happen to have enough faith in the entrepreneurial innovative spirit of this nation that I believe that innovation actually can happen without government subsidy and sometimes happens better without government subsidy.
Just ask both of you. We talked about the coal industry. Do you believe, I mean, in many ways, Trump is promising that those jobs will be restored. Will that happen? Will the jobs in the coal industry be restored to the levels of the past?
I don't see how, Leon. I mean, for a number of reasons. One, technology is actually making coal production better. So that means fewer jobs and more output. Number two, the competing technologies with coal, even in terms of the market, and that is many of them green, non-fossil technologies, are doing better and better. Even if you didn't have government there, you would still have a trend against coal. So it's like manufacturing. I don't see how we can talk realistically about these coal jobs staying there. That doesn't mean we abandon West Virginia. I mean, I'm not suggesting that. In fact, I think we can have regional development, we can have job retraining, we can have the kinds of programs that I used to supervise in the Labor Department that actually did have an impact. But we invest in people. We don't have to abandon anybody, but artificially protecting industries or jobs, it seems to me, is not in the interest of those people or the United States as a whole.
The coal industry is not going to be as it once was in the 1950s. There's no question about that. And there are competing technologies, natural gas being one of them. And I think one of the problems is Trump is unique in many ways, but he is not unique in promising too much and delivering too little. Obama promised a lot, and he didn't deliver much of it, and it's why people got frustrated and anxious. And so to me, the greatest, can the coal industry be made better? Yes, absolutely, because so many of the regulations in the last couple years have been crippling. I happen to believe handing over our energy future to a bunch of bureaucrats around the world makes no sense at all, so I'm not a fan of the Paris Agreement, I never have been. But when politicians promise the sky, I can bring all those jobs back, hope and change, whatever it is. What happens is ultimately people are disappointed. Their expectations are dashed, and they become more cynical and more disengaged. And that's, of course, the problem with our politics. And I think it's why citizens being actively engaged and staying involved in the debate is so important. It's why it's important the Panetta Institute exists and that you all come.
Okay, we're going to turn to an economic question here.
By the way, can I just say, I used to go down into coal mines. As Secretary of Labor, I spent a lot of time in coal mines. Do you know that a typical coal mine shaft in West Virginia is 5 feet by 5 feet? I was the only one who could march through there. at a very high clip.
All right, where are U.S. interest rates likely heading over the next 1 to 4 years? And how will the effect of these interest rates impact on the U.S. economy and the global economy? Bob?
Well, Janet Yellen, as everybody knows, has started raising interest rates. And I think it's understandable. There is worry, and she has been a dove on inflation, but there is some worry that as we get tighter and tighter in terms of labor markets and utilization of all our resources, there could be some more inflation. But I would caution against her doing too much of it. I think she's heading in the right direction at about the right pace. I don't think interest rates should go up much more. Will they? I don't think they will, Leon. She's very sensible, and the Open Market Committee is very good. They're looking at a lot of data, and I think they're going to be very careful.
Carly?
Well, I think they need to rise. I don't disagree with Bob that they need to rise cautiously at this point. But I would just remind people that a low interest rate environment hurts who? Retirees. It hurts people who are trying to save money. So we've had a system now, I mean, lots of, you know, companies who borrow money love it. But if you're a retiree, or if you're a young married couple trying to save for your first home, or you're struggling to make ends meet, interest rates matter to you. And so I do think to help the American people, we've got to have some increase, and I happen to believe interest rates stayed too low for too long. And I think interest rates that are too low for too long also allow politicians to just keep walking away from the fact that we're spending way more than we're taking in, and ultimately that does become a problem, even for the federal government.
Okay, another area where there's been talk about creating jobs in America is the whole issue of funding infrastructure. As you mentioned, Bob, a lot of support on both Democratic and Republican side for the need to repair and rebuild our infrastructure in this country. This question is, can you discuss the pros and cons of infrastructure funding either through tax credits, incentives, I guess some have suggested that in the Republican House, versus government spending? I think there's been talk, the president talked about a $1 trillion investment in infrastructure. And so compare that and public versus private ownership of infrastructures.
You know, one of the things that I know after years of experience is you concentrate too much money and too much power and too much decision making in too few hands for too long. The power gets abused, the money gets wasted, and the decisions generally are ineffective. I've also said that because of the nature of the 21st century, bureaucracies get more and more strained and less effective. Therefore, I think we have to think carefully about which problems we ask the federal government to solve. Now, it turns out infrastructure is one of the problems that even in the Constitution, the federal government is supposed to solve. So this is a place where Bob and I are going to agree that yes, the federal government needs to play a real role in infrastructure building and infrastructure development, and clearly our country needs that. I also think this is a place where public-private partnerships would be helpful, actually, because I think, for example, you could create a whole set of incentives and benchmark structures that would ensure that money is spent more effectively. You could, for example, allow communities and states to identify the projects as opposed to those projects being identified from the top down. I think there are many examples around the world and in communities in this country where public-private partnerships have worked. And so I hope this is an area where Republicans and Democrats can come together. There is most definitely a role for the federal government. There is a role for the private sector, and there is a real need here.
Bob?
Well, I think that that's right. And I when Donald Trump asked me the first thing he should be doing, I told him, no, he didn't ask me. But if he had, I would say infrastructure would be the obvious one. The deferred maintenance everybody knows about, it's just a huge problem. We deal with it every day. We know that our infrastructure is crumbling. There are a lot of different ways of financing it. And I agree with Carly, there are ways of public-private partnerships. We forget, all of us, and maybe some of us didn't know, in the 1950s, the two biggest and most important programs that the federal government did and undertook that generated economic growth both started with the terms national defense, but they really didn't have much directly to do with it. One was the National Defense Education Act, and the other was the National Defense Highway Act. Yeah. And they created, both of them, one a human capital infrastructure, the other a kind of transportation and solid infrastructure for the country, and we have not done anything similar on that scale since.
At least a preliminary budget was submitted by the administration that recommended increasing defense $54 billion and then cutting a lot of domestic programs, including the State Department budget. Pretty significantly. So this is a question, I've got two questions here, but they basically deal with that issue. How does major cuts to the State Department affect our ability to interact with other countries in negotiating trade and security agreements and impact jobs in the wider U.S. economy? And then specifically, how do cuts in programs like the Army Corps of Engineers, NOAA, education, the Transit Capital Investment Program help advance America's interests? I guess the general question is, do you agree with the priorities that were established in that initial Trump budget, which is probably dead on arrival?
Well, in brief, no. But let me tell you how I think we ought to think about this. First of all, there is opportunity to save money, to be more efficient and more effective in every single department. I agree in broad strokes that we need to invest more in our military. There is no doubt. I also believe that handing the Pentagon $54 billion in a single year is going to mean a lot of money is going to get wasted, because it's too much money too fast, in my humble opinion, having spent a lot of time in the Pentagon. And there's opportunity to be more efficient in the Pentagon. I do not agree that the State Department budget should be cut to the bone, although there is opportunity to be far more efficient in the State Department. And I've spent a lot of time in the State Department looking at their IT systems. Just as one example, the IT systems in the State Department are woefully inadequate. And that's a place where investment is needed, and yet clearly there is bureaucracy and waste. I know it's an old-fashioned idea, it doesn't have a lot of currency, but how do we budget in a business? How do we budget in a family? Basically, what we do is called zero-based budgeting. You know, we start with every dollar, and we say, where are we going to spend the dollars? And somehow in Washington, we have this calcified mess of a budget where once something is given money, it's very, very, very difficult to take that money away. And so here we are in this terrible situation. Donald Trump also promised that he would never touch entitlements. And once you take Social Security, I mean, this is obvious, the numbers work this way. If you take Social Security and Medicare off the table, then you're making these kinds of choices, which I think are not going to be particularly effective, either for defense or for state.
Bob? Well, if you try to increase the military budget by 10%, and if you're not touching Social Security, and you're not touching Medicare, and you're not touching interest payments, hello?
Yep. Doesn't add up.
There's not much left, particularly for all of your programs, education and job training and the poor people and everything else. So it doesn't really add up, particularly if you are concerned about the budget deficit, which we haven't talked about very much, Leon. I think it's a little bit crazy to increase the defense budget and to cut diplomacy. I mean, it sends, think of the signal that sends around the world when we're cutting our State Department budget and we're increasing our defense budget. I mean, let me ask, just if there is on the stage here a former defense secretary, for example, what he might think about this. Oh, Leon, there you are.
Well, you know, the reality is when I was secretary, we were handed a number of $500 billion to cut the defense budget. As a result of the Congress passing the Budget Control Act. I looked at it as an opportunity to try to focus on what kind of role do we have to implement in the 21st century. And I thought that it was an opportunity to really develop an agile and mobile task defense force to put us on the cutting edge of technology, to be able to do the kind of investments we should do, and at the same time, find areas where we can do savings. I mean, I don't mind, an increase, a gradual increase in the defense budget. What I do mind is the uncertainty of the budget in Washington, because the worst thing that the Defense Department can face is uncertainty.
That's right.
And the problem is with this crazy sequester, this cut across the board, they're not dealing with that. So next year you could have a sequester and we would go up and then down and then, I mean, it's just, that is what doesn't make sense in terms of the budget. Which brings me to the issue that you raised, which is the increasing debt in this country. We've got a $20 trillion debt. CBO just announced this week that the debt is going to virtually triple over the next three decades. It's going to go from what is now 77% of GDP to 150% of GDP. It is not sustainable. CBO says it's not sustainable. Both parties obviously have expressed concerns. But neither is really willing to deal with the issues that you have to deal with, as you pointed out, in the budget. And I guess my question is, will there ever be enough courage to put everything on the table and come to a budget agreement that really does try to reduce the deficit in the future?
Well, not so far. I mean, how long have we been talking about this? And the consequence of basically giving every government agency more money every year is not better government. It's actually worse government. There is such thing as too much money and too much fat. We all know this. So I think courage is the right term. And I think it's why, as citizens, forget what party we are, we have to be thinking now. What is the role of the federal government? What is it that only the federal government can do and therefore should do? Because we just cannot continue to keep throwing every problem into the lap of national politicians. How much money have we spent on poverty alleviation and the war on poverty? Trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars since the war on poverty was declared, and yet poverty is not better. So money and federal government attention is not a guarantee of success, far from it. And so as a conservative, as somebody who thinks the Constitution actually gives us some guidance in what the federal government should do and what they shouldn't do, but I think just as a financial reality now, in addition to courage, we need to ask the fundamental question, as Democrats and Republicans and citizens, what is it the federal government should be doing? And what should they not be doing? Because we can't afford all the things they are doing, and the money being spent isn't solving a lot of these festering problems.
The first time I met Bob Reich, I was had been appointed director. I don't even know if I was director of OMB at the time.
No, you were.
I might
actually
have been,
you were head of the budget committee.
I was chairman of the budget committee, and Bob came in with the new administration, to ask about the deficit and what to do. And I think at that time, he was actually, when he came into my office, he was about 6 feet tall.
That's my joke. You can't take my joke. I was, but actually, literally, I was. And I was in charge of the economic transition for the Clinton administration, and I came into Leon's office and said, well, what should we do? And he said, budget deficit reduction. Three words. And I said, you expect me to take back that back to the new president? And he said, yes. And that was a very valuable piece of information, because for the next what, 6 months, Leon and I and the president and the vice president and a couple other people in the cabinet sat around a table. We went through every item in the federal budget, and we actually made decisions that ultimately balanced the budget in 3 years. Yeah. And in other words, it can be done. It's painful, but it can be done. And we ended up with a surplus. Now, that surplus disappeared in the next administration, but I'm not going to talk about that. But undoubtedly, it is important to get control over this, but it's also important to really understand the context. I mean, Carla, you said, for example, that the war on poverty didn't reduce poverty. The biggest single piece of legislation in the war on poverty was Medicare. And Medicare dramatically reduced poverty among the elderly. We know that. We have data on that. So I think it's just important to know that you've got to, it does require courage, it requires patience, and it requires diligence. And here again, I'm going to give huge credit to Leon Panetta, who deserves every bit of it.
Let me just add, by the way, I agree with Bob about Medicare. But you see, I think sometimes that's the problem. We assume that because some government dollars are spent well, all government dollars are spent well. Yeah, that one was spent well, but there were many, 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 many other dollars that haven't been spent well. And I do think that that balanced budget, Bill Clinton famously declared the era of big government is over. Not so much. And Republicans and Democrats alike have contributed to big government. This isn't a Democrat problem. Republicans have presided over increase in spending year after year after year. As citizens, we have a nonpartisan problem, which is that Washington never, ever, ever wants to give anything up. Not their power, not their money, not their decision-making authority. And ultimately, we're going to have them give up some things as part of a budget solution.
Well, let me just, as the moderator here, just say a few words, because I've been through this on the deficit. If you're hearing either one side or the other say that we ought to balance the budget, but they're not willing to take on either entitlements or taxes, or deal with defense, or deal with discretionary, then they're fooling you.
Yep.
It's not going to happen. Sorry. If you're serious about a $20 trillion debt, then you've got to put everything on the table. You've got to put both Republicans and Democrats in the room, and they've got to make decisions on entitlement savings, on taxes, on defense spending, and on discretionary spending. That's how we balanced the budget in the past, and that's the only way we'll balance the budget in the future.
You're here. I agree.
I feel a lot better as a result.
I do too. Thank you, Will.
We've got just a few minutes here, but let me ask this question from our audience. Does the withdrawal from TPP hurt the influence of America abroad and open the door for China to lead with regards to trade?
Well, I was not a big fan of TPP, as I said, because I think we had too many parties negotiating for too long behind closed doors. And I think in that kind of setting, special interests can, corporate interests, can have undue influence, and I also think our interests were not necessarily served. So I think withdrawing from TPP was the right thing to do. I think whether or not we continue to exert more influence than China has is a policy question. I worry, for example, we talked about the State Department budget. China is making huge investments in the developing world. We have a very different system than China, but our business community is very influential in the developing world, and there should be a lot more effective public-private partnerships with the State Department, as an example, to make some of these investments. So, no, we do not need to cede our influence in the world because we withdrew from TPP, but we do need to recognize that China is a competitor for leadership in the world.
Bob?
Well, I don't think we need to worry about China now that Jared Kushner is in charge of the China desk. No, I'm being ironic. I don't think the TPP really would have made much difference because, Carly, as you suggested, the business community in the United States is doing is really doing somersaults to get into the China market, and the TPP would not have helped that necessarily or hindered it. It was designed to actually fortify other nations around China. I objected to the TPP as well for slightly different reasons, I think, Carly. But what we need to do is be very, very smart with regard to diplomacy around China. China is if we have a North Korea problem, as we do, China is the key to dealing with North Korea. We can't assume that we can wipe out North Korea with tactical nuclear missiles or whatever we are now thinking about. China's also the key to dealing with a lot of the other issues. Even, you know, the Chinese border, the western border of China is in the Middle East. So I believe that we need big time diplomacy, really smart diplomacy. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the conclusion of the program. We've had two outstanding speakers here, but more importantly, we've talked about issues that impact not just on our economy, but on the future of our country. I think the key to dealing with these issues is an American people that stay involved in our democracy, that care about our future, and that make your views known to those who represent you, particularly in this area. Thank you very much.